Good afternoon. The Health Human Service Policy Committee will now come to order. Representative Finstead moves that the minutes from the March 1st meeting would be adopted. Is there any discussion on the minutes of the March 1st meeting? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. The first bill on the before the committee today is House File 436. Representative Holberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. As per your instruction, I think that what I'm just here today to facilitate moving this bill back to the House floor. Last year, we took extensive testimony on both sides of this issue. It's an issue that most, if not all, legislators are very familiar with, and given the committee chair's direction, I'm hoping that somebody on this committee will move this back to the general register. And
Representative Holmberg, I would move that House File 436 be recommended to pass and that would be re-referred to the general register. That motion is before us. Is that your motion that you do like that motion?
I do like that motion.
I like it, too. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Paymar.
So, Representative Holbrook, so if I understand correctly that what your bill is doing, just refresh my memory from last session. So this would mean that any nonprofit organization or any entity that gets a local public health grant or a family planning special project grant, if they even mention to someone that abortion services were available, would that mean that they were ineligible to receive grant money?
Representative Holbrook.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, yes.
Representative Paymar.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, let's just say you're a woman going to you know, any number of nonprofit agencies, you're going to see a counselor, and you know, you're pregnant, you want to know what your options are. I mean, this would prohibit someone from even mentioning the word abortion. Not advocating. I understand what your motive is in that respect, but to even suggest that there is an option available would be prohibited under your bill. Otherwise, that entity would lose its grant money.
Representative Holbrook.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, I didn't reread through the bill today. I'm now refreshing my memory here. On page 2, it says may provide non-directive counseling related to pregnancy, but may not directly refer patients who seek abortion services to any organization that provides abortion services.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, so if a woman asked a counselor at one of those agencies if there was abortion services available in their city or their county, they could not say yes and could not direct them where that might be or give them a phone number or anything like that.
That would be correct.
Representative Holbrook.
Sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, that would be correct.
And Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, I want to get your rationalization for this. I mean, why you think this is the right thing to do on the record.
Representative Holbrook.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, this is the distribution of grant monies. This would not prohibit any organization from doing that. It would only prohibit those organizations that are receiving state funds for family planning from doing that.
Representative Paymar.
Representative Holbrook, I'm still trying to get to why you're trying to do this. I understand they're getting state funds, but if they're not advocating an abortion but simply giving a woman referral information, the woman decides on her own whether she wanted to make that choice or not. You're not advocating, just giving information out. You're, in a sense, stopping any free speech between that entity and that woman. And I want to know why.
Representative Paymar, you're asking a couple things. First of all, you're questioning Representative Holberg's motives in bringing the bill forward, or You know, you asked me a couple things. Let's be specific about...
I want to know why.
Is it the purpose of the bill, perhaps?
Yes.
That's a legitimate question. Representative Holberg.
If you're operating the bill, it's not your motive so much. It's what's the rationalization for it. I mean, I think you should be clear what you're asking this committee to vote on.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, the intent of the bill is that state tax dollars not be used, and these are family planning grant dollars, which most would agree that abortion is not family planning, that family planning grants not be used to support abortion.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the House File 436 be recommended pass, be re-referred to General Register, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, I ask for a division.
Division has been requested. All those in favor of that motion, say aye. Raise your hands. All those opposed for that motion. The division is 9-4, and the motion does prevail.
Next on the agenda is House File 2537. Representative Boudreaux, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would move that House File 2537 be recommended to pass and I believe be re-referred to the General Register.
Representative Boudreaux moves House File 2537 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Boudreaux.
Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment. First of all, this bill was passed in the Senate. There was an amendment that was added, and so I would move Amendment A1.
Representative Boudreaux moves the A1 amendment. Is this to get it in the order you wish to discuss?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That's correct.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Boudreaux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I would just like to explain a little bit what the bill does. The bill, House File 2537, modifies the Adverse Health Care Event Reporting System, and it expands the Adverse Health Care Event Reporting System to cover reports from health-related licensing boards. It expands the exclusion of maltreatment of vulnerable adults from adverse health events to maltreatment of minors and to neglect under both the Minors or Vulnerable Adults Maltreatment Reporting Acts. I know that's a mouthful, but essentially it does some of the same things that the adverse reporting system did for hospitals is now doing for the Board of Medical Practice. And it was the request of the Board of Medical Practice that the bill is before us. And I would like to have some of those advocates that are very much have worked hard on this bill to come forward and to present their reasoning and logic. I think Marie Dotseth is one.
Marie Dotseth?
And please. Who else, Marie, do you want? Should David Feinwax is here. He can also testify.
Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Hello. My name is Marie Dotseth. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. And I was brought on board in January to help implement this law that you all passed last year. And wisely, you all established a transition period because some of these issues are very complex. So we've been working with a number of folks, and most recently and most directly with the hospitals and the Hospital Association. And the portion of this change to get the bill implemented as it was passed last year that we're looking for are the changes that are very consistent with the policy that you had adopted last year, and they are to clarify that the data you protected last year is peer review protected while this information is being transmitted to the Department of Health. to clarify that when it's at the Department of Health, that it remains non-public. And as Representative Boudreaux said, to clarify that consistent with the changes you made to the Vulnerable Adults Act last year, these events are reported as adverse events for pediatric patients as well, and gives us the ability to follow up any questions we might have about these reports under the adverse event bill. And we've been working hard to make sure we can implement this bill the way you guys passed it last year, and we think this does it. So. And we've been working with the hospitals as well.
And the hospitals are nodding their head. Yes. Is that it for now?
That's it.
Okay. Questions from the committee. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thompson. I just want to be sure, because it appears as though the commissioner is being asked to do some things, that there are no additional costs that would be involved in this bill?
There are no additional costs in the changes here.
Thank you.
Further questions? Is there any further testimony in favor of the bill? Is there anyone who would like to testify against the bill? Yeah. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare. We have one main concern about this. Last year, when we expressed concerns about this bill, we were told that what was going to happen is that the information would be gathered and there would be no individual data gathered. And now the bill includes ranking, well, it says it will contain data on individuals. It'll be confidential, but still it is data that's on individuals, and it's being collected. And that was part of what we thought the agreement was last year in moving this bill forward, was that there wouldn't be confidential data. So one thing is that it has that data. The other thing is that it's you just move to move it right to the general register and not through the civil law committee. So we're concerned about the collection of the data, which seems to be different than what we had agreed on last year, and then it's not going to civil law. Thank you.
Representative Boudreaux.
Mr. Chairman, I do have someone who would like to respond to those comments. Mr. Feinwachs.
Mr. Feinwachs.
And also, Mr. Chairman, if this needs to go to civil law, I mean, I'm certainly willing to send it there. It's not my intent to...
Has there been a request from the chair at this point?
Not that I'm aware of. I should have asked her. She's probably gone.
We can always redirect. Mr. Feinwachs, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Feinwachs. I am general counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association, and we have worked closely with the Minnesota Department of Health on this measure, which we had viewed as non-controversial. Let me address Ms. Brace's comments. The reports which we make and the law which this legislature passed this past year contain no patient identifiable data. The data that's being contemplated in this bill has to do with the fact that the Department of Health has obligations under Medicare and other federal laws to inspect and visit hospitals and to investigate certain things that happen in hospitals, and the information that they collect in the course of that type of investigation, which is mandated by federal law and which I doubt anyone on this committee would suggest shouldn't happen, be protected. That's the kind of information. We are not breaching the law of last year. We are not reporting patient-identified, provider-identified anything. The reports are what the statute requires. This has to do with information collected during the course of investigations.
Questions from the committee? Representative Boudreaux, or maybe if Mr. Feinwachs would like to comment, or are you satisfied that whether civil law needs to see the bill or not?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I think the best decision would be to just move it to the general register. I will convey the suggestion to the civil law chair, and if Representative Holberg needs to see it, I'd be happy to re-refer it.
Okay.
I'm not so sure it needs to go there, to be honest with you.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Boudreaux renews her motion to re-refer House File 2537 to the General Register as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The bill passes.
Okay, the next bill before us is House File 352. Representative Wilkin.
And Chair, if we could just have a moment to fire up the computer here. Baby was on the computer before. It's not a shameless ploy for votes or anything like that.
Representative Wilkin, is that your youngest?
That's the youngest. Okay, we got a
good-looking kid.
That's true. Good-looking kid. Members, while we're waiting here, I did send the committee administrator to find out if that bill that we just passed does need to go to civil law, because it wasn't my understanding it did. But so we'll find out. Representative Wilkin, you have an amendment. Did you want to wait, or is
while we move the bill, and I'll work and as we go, and I'll move House File 352 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Okay, that amendment is before, or that motion is before us.
Then I will move the. I don't have my amendment with me. Let's see. I do have it, the A1 amendment, to get in the shape.
Representative Wilkin moves the A1 amendment, and this is to put the bill in its desired context. Is there any discussion on amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
For the A drive. Okay, members.
Representative Wilkin.
This bill is to amend the current law, which provides minors to be able to consent to their own treatment in the areas of pregnancy, venereal disease, chemical dependency, and family planning. The intent is to put the parents back in the responsible position so that they can fulfill their parental responsibilities. And I had planned on doing a little bit more of a presentation myself, but I think the presentation from the witnesses will be much more powerful than anything that I could say today. So I would like to introduce to you Professor Teresa Collette from the University of St. Thomas Law School.
Welcome to the committee, Professor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please restate your name for our tape.
Certainly.
Madam Chairman, my name is Teresa Collette. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas. The areas I teach include constitutional law, bioethics, and property law. I'm delighted to be here to testify in support of Representative Wilkins. I've written several articles in the area of parental involvement in health care for minors, and I believe that this particular bill will advance the interest of Minnesota minors as well as the interest of their parents today. Your Honor, Madam Chair, at this point in time, I believe copies of my written testimony are being distributed to the committee, and it is important to note that there are several interests that are being advanced. The present state of the law allows minors to self-consent in several areas. Minors can self-consent to treatment in the area of alcohol and substance abuse, in the area of STD treatment, in the area of pregnancy-related treatment. That in of itself may seem like sound public policy, but in addition to self-consent, once the minor self-consents, that portion of the minor's medical record is closed to the minor's parents, absent the minor consenting to the medical record being opened. Or there is a possibility that the physician can open the minor's medical record to the parent if the physician is persuaded that the minor's health is jeopardized. I would suggest that since the 1970s, when in fact this legislation was passed, that we have seen a deterioration of minors' health and well-being in the state of Minnesota. And in fact, this is not sound public policy. What follows in my written presentation as well as my oral presentation is, I believe, solid evidence that in fact minors do not flourish by this isolation from their parents, but instead prosper when minors are indeed influenced by the guidance and direction of their parents. Let's begin with mental health. According to the Surgeon General of the United States, 1 in 10 children and adolescents suffer from mental illness enough to cause some level of impairment. And yet, only 1 in 5 each year will receive specialty mental health services. These problems include depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, attention deficit disorders, eating disorders, autism and other pervasive developmental disorders, and schizophrenia. In addition to that, they will be treated through cognitive therapy and pharmacology. One of the problems with these treatments is that they've been developed in the context of adults. Clinical trials have been done using adult subjects. They've not been developed with adolescents, and thus the physicians that are prescribing them have not had sound scientific research to know the proper therapeutic dosages for at least the drugs they're using. In the absence of adult supervision for any monitoring of adverse effects, the minors themselves may not note adverse behavioral effects or adverse problems that may develop during the treatment mode. It's very important that parents be a part of that therapeutic decision and therapy monitoring afterwards. The average American child in the 1980s reported more anxiety than child psychiatric patients in the 1950s. And in fact, from 1952 to 1996, according to the Surgeon General of the United States, adolescent suicide has tripled. And suicide in the state of Minnesota is the second cause of adolescent death, according to the Department of Minnesota Health. What about alcohol and drug abuse? Well, in 1998, the Minnesota Student Survey indicates that 54% of high school freshmen had at least one drink in the past 30 days, and those also had 5 or more consecutive drinks on at least one occasion in the past 2 weeks, what we call binge drinking. That percentage increased to 63% by the time they were seniors. Alcoholism is the drug of choice for our high schoolers, and it's a serious problem. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to encourage adults not to sell or to use alcohol with minors in this state, and yet we exclude parents in the treatment decision? This is an illogical policy. When adults are substance or alcohol impaired, we question their judgment. Minors, by definition, do not have the judgment that we expect of adults. By definition, we don't let them enter into contracts. By definition, we don't hold them to the legal standards of adults. And yet, under the current state of the law, if they're alcohol or substance impaired, we emancipate them for purposes of making treatment decisions? This makes no sense. What about sexually transmitted diseases in pregnancy? Well, the Center for Disease Control characterizes it as a silent epidemic. Venereal diseases have increased dramatically over the last 40 years. And in fact, between 2001 and 2002, the rate of Minnesotans infected with chlamydia increased by 21%, and the number of people suffering with gonorrhea increased by 13%. The largest segment of those suffering, according to the Department of Health in Minnesota, are between the ages of 15 and 24. Readily available statistics from the same Department of Health reveals that the rate of chlamydia infections has increased every year for the past 6 years, and gonorrhea, 5 out of the past 6 years. The incidence and prevalence of genital herpes has increased dramatically during the past 30 years, and the number of clinically diagnosed cases of symptomatic genital herpes in the 1980s was 11 times that of the 1970s when we enacted this isolation of our minors in this state. It has remained relatively constant since. Why is it that teens are particularly susceptible to sexually transmitted diseases? Well, in large part, it's because the cervix of teenage girls is uniquely susceptible to the growth of viruses and bacteria. When a girl reaches her 20s or has a baby, this lining is replaced by a tougher lining, and it's more resistant to bacteria. For example, a 15-year-old girl has a 1 in 8 chance of pelvic inflammatory disease simply by having sex, whereas a 24-year-old woman has only a 1 in 8 chance from every 1 in 80 chance from every similar situation. A recent report from the CDC published by the Guttmacher Institute, the research arm of Planned Parenthood, indicates that the lifetime direct medical cost of this is $6.5 billion. Between 1997 and 1999, almost 25 per 1,000 15 to 17-year-old girls became pregnant in the state of Minnesota. The vast majority of these pregnancies are unintended, and the teen pregnancy rate in Minnesota among white students is something we can be rightfully proud of. It's one of the lowest in the country. Unfortunately, that's not true for our African-American kids. It's one of the highest in the country. In fact, it's one of the goals of the Department of Health to change that. So, how do we change that? Well, there's a growing body of research that says the way we change it is getting parents involved. And in fact, the Minnesota Department of Health agrees. In their agenda for strategies for public health, that is their very first strategy for adolescents, is developing parental involvement. Quote, "Very little attention is given to the important role that parents play in the healthy development of their adolescent children. Their importance in the lives of their teens is strongly supported in research, particularly current research on resiliency." The Surgeon General and national studies find that substance abuse was lower among youths who believed their parents would strongly disapprove of their substance use compared with those who felt their parents somewhat disapproved, or those who thought their parents would neither approve or disapprove. Disapproval of adolescent contraception protects teens from earlier sexual involvement as well as from pregnancy. Research consistently reveals that, quote, greater parental supervision and involvement related to girls being more sexually assertive, delaying sexual initiation, and using dual contraception, and being less likely to become pregnant or acquire an STD. These research reports are not from some right-wing organization. These are government reports, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and other organizations that have consistently supported the availability of contraception and the availability of abortion. These are reports that consistently show that when parents are involved, teens make good choices. This law, as it currently exists, is counterproductive. How else will teens benefit from Representative Wilkes' bill? Well, as with all medical procedures, one of the most important guarantees of patient well-being is the professional competence of those who provide medical care. As the United States Supreme Court observed in Bilotti v. Baird, in this case, we're concerned only with minors who, according to the record, range in age from children of 12 years to 17-year-old teenagers. Even in the latter case, they are less likely than adults to know or be able to recognize ethical, qualified positions or have the means to engage such professionals. Second, parental consent will ensure that parents have the opportunity to provide additional medical history and information to medical health care professionals prior to treatment. The importance of this information, as well as the unique ability of parents to provide it, has been noted also by the United States Supreme Court. An adequate medical history and psychological case history is important to the physician. So said the United States Supreme Court in H.L. versus Matheson. The third way in which medical parental involvement is important is that healthcare providers can inform the parents of the treatment plan so that the risk can be assessed by an adult. And then finally, they can deal with the consequences. They can assess that. The United States Supreme Court has recognized the existence of abusive parents and have stated, and I quote, "The statist notion that governmental power should supersede parental authority in all cases because some parents abuse and neglect children is repugnant to the American tradition." Representative Wilkins' bill is the right idea at the right time. It's supported by empirical research, and I strongly urge this committee to pass it. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Paymer has a question.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Ms. Collette, I think in an ideal world, we all would want greater parental involvement in all of these issues that you've raised, but we don't live in an ideal world. And you mentioned some research, and I just want your response to some other research that has been done on the very issues that are raised in this bill. There was a study in 2002 in the Journal of American Medical Association that found that mandatory parental notification for prescribed contraceptives would impede girls' use of sexual health care services, potentially increasing teen pregnancies and spreads and the spread of STDs. The study found that 59% of the respondents would stop using all sexual health care services and delay testing or treatment for HIV and other STDs. Would you care to respond to that research?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Collette.
In fact, that study was based on a survey of the girls asking what they would hypothetically do. I suspect if we asked all high school students if we should send their grades to parents so that they can respond to poor grades, we would receive a similar response, that we shouldn't send grades home for discipline either. However, the only study I know where there's actually been a control group of young adolescents where they had the option of seeking treatment on their own tested against a control group of adolescents who received medical care or notice of needed medical care and their parents received notice of needed medical care was done in Israel. And in that case, where there was actually a study done on conduct as opposed to hypothetical posed to students, the actual health care that was received was greater among those students where parents received it, because the parents ensured that the students both made the appointment for the health care and received the health care. I have no doubt that students do not want their parents to know of their sexual conduct. In addition to that, only last month, the Guttmacher Institute, again, Planned Parenthood's research arm, published a study of young women who are at high risk of pregnancy, many of whom had already experienced an adolescent pregnancy, and their use of contraception. And they found that 69% of those that used high potential contraception, either the Depo-Provera shot or the pill, as opposed to condoms, were those that were accompanied by their mother rather than those who came unaccompanied by any adult. So I would suggest that that study is far more accurate since it's based on actual experience rather than a hypothetical posed to high school students.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Ms. Collette, I find it somewhat ironic that you've been referencing Planned Parenthood in this committee. I thought that was an anathema to in this body. But nevertheless, what about the study that said that 80% of unmarried adolescent females would not seek birth control if their parents had to be told, and that less than 1% would discontinue their sexual relations? Are you familiar with that research?
Professor Collette.
Madam Chair. Again, it's a hypothetical study posed to students asking what they would do in the future, and yet the studies that have actually been done on student behavior does not mirror that.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you.
Representative Walker.
Never mind, ma'am. Madam Chair.
Any other questions for Professor Collette? Our next witness, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dr. Ross Olson.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Ross Olson. I'm a pediatrician with four children, four grandchildren. I practiced for over 35 years, including the U.S. Navy, Pilot City Health Center in Minneapolis, a college health service and emergency room in Illinois, a hospital and clinic in Hong Kong, and most recently for 23 years with a large HMO here in the Twin Cities. My opinions arise from my experience and my concern for the long-term consequences not only of my own patients, but also to all children and adolescents growing up in our increasingly dangerous world. The idea that teens need absolute confidentiality in their medical care is based on a reasonable assumption that otherwise they would not seek care. After all, it is hard enough to get them to talk about significant issues anyway. But it doesn't necessarily work that way, and there are serious unintended consequences to that policy, because it is based on a number of unwarranted assumptions. One is this: it's assumed that the average family is dysfunctional. When a 16-year-old girl says, "My mom will kill me if she finds out I'm sexually active," the caring professional may downgrade the potential scenario from murder to mild mayhem, but still basically agree that telling the parents would result in nothing good. This means that the professional thinks that he or she knows better and cares more for the adolescent than the parent, or perhaps assumes that the teen is completely competent to make these decisions independently. And yet the parent, for better or for worse, is the parent for life, and the professional will be in the picture at best for a relatively short term. Thus, the policy drives a wedge between the parent and the child and separates parents from life-changing decisions whose consequences will affect them regardless. Another effect of this policy is to promote the illusion that if nobody knows, nothing happened, or that things can be undone as if they never occurred, or even that with proper technology, risky behavior can be made safe. Teens are not good at long-term planning, and many professionals have the attitude that the best we can do for them is to blunt the effects of their actions. I call this the animal model of adolescence. That sort of thinking never considers that there is great value to a high standard, as we now have with smoking, even if many fall short. Would repeal of total confidentiality leave medical providers in the uncomfortable position of being stool pigeons with no room for wisdom? When a teen comes to me with a concern and says, don't tell my parents, I can say, your parents really need to know about this, and I think you should tell them. I can help you with that. Finally, unconsidered in the equations of the confidentiality proponents is the deterrent effect of potential discovery. If we adults are honest, we will admit that at least sometimes the reason we control our impulses boils down to fear of what would happen if we were found out. A concrete example of this occurred when Minnesota had a parental notification law for minors seeking abortion. During that time, not only did abortions decline, but also births for girls under 18. Apparently, because of fear disclosure, behavior actually changed. That's from Rogers et al., the American Journal of Public Health, 91. The confidentiality policy makes it easy to think that nobody will ever know. It is not true, of course, and even if it were, the consequences are still real. What we don't know, or what parents don't know, can hurt. It can hurt them, their children, and all of us. I guess it amounts to a philosophical difference. Do we just want to wait at the bottom of the cliff and pick up the injured, or build a fence at the top? Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. And we have a tape going, so we ask that you, if it's okay, you can say your first name, or you don't have to say your name if you don't want to identify yourselves, but just so we can refer to you.
My name is Amanda and I'm 16, and when I was in ninth grade and at age 14, I attended a public school, and my counselor, who knew of my drug behavior and my sexual relationships, gave me a pass to go with four of my friends to a public clinic down the street. And we arrived at the clinic, and some of my older friends who were in 11th grade were receiving birth control pills, and they had been getting them for 3 years without their parents knowing. And the clinic receptionist asked my friends and I if our parents knew we were there, and three of us, including myself, responded no. And she had us fill out a form of confidentiality. And when I started to go to the school, my mother had filled out a medical form requesting that I not receive treatment from this clinic. And however, the school sent me there to be tested for an STD and to take a pregnancy test. And at this point, I had run away from home and was living with different friends, but mostly was a friend who was a 19-year-old male. And I was going to go home so that my mom could take me to the doctor, and he convinced me to stay with him and to go to this clinic because it was free and that my parents didn't have to know. I'm 100% in favor of this bill. If it had been the law at time, I would have told my mom that I needed to go to the doctor. The terror of not knowing the test results was unbearable. And if the law required parental consent, I would have been home where I was supposed to be and not having sexual relations with a 19-year-old male, which is considered statutory rape. And my mom found out from a friend's parents since I had run away from home and was trying to find me, and my mom was mad that my school let me go to the clinic against her wishes, and she was upset that I hadn't told her. I do wish that I had let my mom know, and I never did get the test results from this clinic. I returned home, and my mother sent me to Florida to attend school, and before the results were available, and I wrote to my mom and asked her to get the results, and the clinic wouldn't release them. And there's no possible way that I could call to get them, and they had even denied that I had ever been to the clinic and everything. And I don't think at all that parents are the evil in this situation. I think that the evil is the fact that by law that teenagers are allowed to sneak around behind their parents' backs, and that by law clinics and other officials are allowed to lie about children's behavior to parents who I believe have every right to know what's going on with their children.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Good afternoon.
Hi, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. I support this proposed bill for many different reasons. My name is Sarah. I'm 17 years old. When I was about 14 or 15, I started to become sexually active, involved with alcohol and drugs. My parents were really strict. They were very strict, and so I kept a lot of things from them. Many of my friends had gone to Planned Parenthood or the local clinics to get birth control or condoms or STD checks and pregnancy tests. they could get this done without their parents knowing. So they had gone to a private school with me, and I wanted to go to get birth control, too. My sister had gone to Planned Parenthood to get birth control pills without my parents' knowledge, and as a result, she started using the pill unaware of our family medical history. Our family is allergic to a certain kind of birth control drug, so my sister ended up collapsing in school and had to go to the emergency room for treatment. My parents had no idea where she had gotten the birth control pills, and they asked friends and parents, and they even went to Planned Parenthood, and they turned them away and denied even having treated my sister at all. So I started to go to the clinic to get STD checks and antibiotics to treat chlamydia and pregnancy tests and condoms. I went during school hours and took others with me. When I went to the clinic, they would ask for secret addresses and phone numbers and names of friends so that they can call and report the test results. This was all an effort to keep my parents from learning about my sexual activities, and I missed a lot of school to go to these clinics. One time I got a result saying that I had abnormal cells, and then I got results saying that I had signs of genital warts. At this point, the clinic said they couldn't do any more for me, and they didn't have access to the equipment or the things they needed to proceed on with the medical care. I was 15 and I didn't have any money for treatment, anywhere else for genital warts, so they just turned me away pretty much and said that at this time they had encouraged me to hide my secrets from my parents and then let me go and have me forced to deal with the results myself. I had nowhere else to turn, and I finally told my mom that I had thought I had an infection or something and needed to go to the doctor. So my parents were stressed and worried because of all the secrets and all of the missed school, and still they weren't unable to find out what was going on. And at the doctor's office, the nurse who helped me fill out the forms knew the real reason why I was there. For about 15 to 20 minutes, she told me that I had rights and I didn't have to tell my parents anything. In fact, she tried to talk me out of telling my parents. I was scared and I didn't know if I should sign the confidentiality papers or not. I ended up not signing the paper, even though she tried to sway me to sign the papers. I wouldn't even have known or been able to do anything about the genital warts because of the free clinic wouldn't provide me any more treatment. I was cured of the genital warts, which I'm very thankful for. I continued to have sex and abuse drugs even after this episode. My parents still had no knowledge of my secret life after this because they weren't even given any information from the clinics. I continued to deny it, and I was having sex and using. I didn't have to go to them for STD checks or pregnancy tests or anything. These lies really tore a huge hole between my parents and me. My addiction went much further, and I was having sex with a lot more and very older men, usually not protected, and running away from home at times and skipping school. I never had to go to my parents because I had other options, and that just really encouraged me into not stopping the destruction on myself. I really hit bottom, and my parents couldn't get any information from anyone, so they sent me to a treatment center. I was tired and worn out. Now, I realize many things about this. I believe that if I had the option to go to the clinic without my parents' knowledge, I would have to tell my parents. Even with the fact of how strict my parents are, I couldn't have handled not knowing the STD and pregnancy test results. That fear would have been overwhelming. I had options to go around my parents, and that was more of an invitation to continue what I was doing. Because my sexual and activity drug use was a secret to my parents, and that was wrong. Going to a clinic without my parents' knowledge was hiding this behavior and allowed me to continue it, even when I had the symptoms of genital warts and couldn't get treatment without my parents' help. By telling them about my behavior and going with them to a clinic to get help would have prevented a lot more problems at this time. They would have seen much more earlier that I have it that needed attention, and they could have concentrated on getting me the help I needed. I may not have needed to come to treatment center if I had an earlier intervention at that time. I missed a lot of school because of these passes given to me to go to the clinic during school hours. If I had been going with my parents, I would not have missed so many classes, and I wouldn't have had to make up almost 2 years of school now. My family would not have been torn apart by the secrets and the lies that I told to cover it all up. I fully support this bill. I saw the clinics before as my secret drug dealers. They really supported my habits, no questions asked, and kept it a secret from my parents. This made me feel like it was an encouragement and a door to keep going, when it really was a spiral downwards. This door needs to be closed so that the lies and the secrets can be stopped, and the teenagers have only one option, to open up to our parents, who are the best ones to care for us.
Thank you. I have a question for Amanda and Sarah. Is it common practice for the schools to make appointments during school hours? Could anyone comment on that? It sounds like you're missing a lot of school to go to these appointments. Is that common for girls to be referred from school?
Yes, it is. It's common where I went to school.
I went to private school for 12 years, and yeah, it's common. And then I went to public, and it was even more common. If not, you just skip school to go.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. I support this bill for many reasons, and here's my testimony. I'm Katie, and I'm 21 years old. I grew up in a home where my mom was an active Christian. I was following God's will until I got in the wrong circle of people and started rebelling and going against my parents' back. I started drinking, then having sex when I was about to turn 17. I was able to go to Planned Parenthood to get all the help I needed without my parents even knowing. Planned Parenthood supplied birth control as well as testing for my sexually transmitted diseases. The clinic knew about my alcohol and drug abuse, but did not encourage me to get treatment for that or to involve my parents. In fact, I was encouraged to keep my deep secrets at the clinic as opposed to letting my family in. It caused a deep wall between my parents and me. The secrecy made it easier for me to continue the unhealthy behaviors, drug and alcohol abuse, as well as the sexual activity. If my parents had known what I was doing at the clinic, I would have still gone in for testing and medical treatment. I know the dangers of STDs, and I'm terrified of the results. Still, I continued my unhealthy lifestyle because my parents were not aware of my behavior. My addiction progressed from alcohol and sex to weed, heroin, and meth, and everything in between, to ultimately shooting methamphetamines. I continued the unhealthy lifestyle because I did not feel accountable to anyone. I knew that if my parents had been involved sooner, I would have not have been sucked down as far as I was. Keeping these secrets from my parents just caused more addiction, and it was acceptable, even encouraged, to hide it from them. When you keep secrets from people, you keep them as far away as possible so they don't find out, and that in itself tears families apart.
Thank you, Katie. Have you straightened your life around?
Yeah.
Turned your life around?
Yeah. I'm in treatment right now.
Very good. Very good. Thank you for coming. Are there questions? Representative Bradley, might be a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and sincere thank you to all three of you for having the courage to come before us. I sort of have a couple of questions. Well, let me begin with this one. You're relating to your own experience, but you certainly know other people. Would you be just as strong in your support on behalf of all the friends that you have? Would you say that you'd be willing to tell this legislature not only for your circumstance would have changed, but you believe that it equally applies to the friends that you know? And I guess any of you can comment on that.
Yes.
Most definitely.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Tao.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question for all three of you. If your parents knew, would you have stopped what you were doing?
I would have probably gone to treatment like 3 hours or 3 years earlier than I did, and which would have, you know, helped that 3 years of destruction in my life.
Either Amanda or Sarah want to comment?
If my mom had intervened, my behavior would have stopped because my mother would not have supported it, and I would have respected my mother enough to stop.
I probably wouldn't have been totally right away to stopping everything, but at least then my parents could have gone into counseling or some kind of therapy or at least talk to me about it instead of hiding it all the time. And then I most definitely would have started to change.
Okay, any other questions? Again, thank you for sharing your views. Oh, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, let me address it to Katie to try. I'm wondering about with the way the circumstance was, what happens or what happened to you in terms of your relationships with your parents on an overall level? Does the fact of what you were doing have a bearing on the respectful relationship overall between you and your parents? And under the current law I'm talking about.
Katie, do you understand the question?
Not really. It caused a wall between us, and like, I mean, they're my parents, and they should be guiding my life rather than me hiding stuff from them. They should be telling me what to do and where to go and whatever, instead of me just doing everything behind their back and being encouraged to do it.
That's what I was wondering. Thank you.
Okay. Either one of you want to comment, or you don't have to. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Evelyn Eubanks. And good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. My name is Evelyn Eubanks. I am a mother of six, a grandmother of two, the sister of 11, and an aunt of 43 nieces and nephews. I'm here tonight to speak to an issue that is very close to my heart. I'm here tonight to speak to you of an issue that makes me very concerned. Since the 1970s, we've allowed this to occur. You have an increase in out-of-wedlock births. You have an increase in teenage mortality due to AIDS. We have an increase in children involved in illicit behavior. We also have an increase in numerous things related to sex. And I really believe that the experiment has failed. This is not something that was tried for 6 months, 6 years, 6 days. There have been 20 years, and the statistics, especially in North Minneapolis, where I live, are some of the highest in the nation. I can tell you that this policy usurps parents' authority and responsibility in the direction and care for my children. No one, and I repeat, no one cares more for my children than me. No one knows them better than me. No one advocates better than me. And I should not be, my rights as a parent to provide the care and guidance for my children should not be usurped because somebody else chose not to have that authority. I have a niece who died at 28 years old. When we went to the hospital to find out, we found out she had been HIV positive for years. When the nurse asked her how long she had been HIV positive, she turned and looked at me and she began to cry. We cried as well. My niece had 3 children. I have 4 nieces that had children at the age of 14, 15, and 16. All of them had TAMS, Teenage Medical Clinic cards in their purse. To take children and to give them this kind of authority and to treat them as adults in this area is wrong. We are saying that when it comes to sex, drug, and alcohol, there are no children. You can be an adult and have the same rights and privileges as adults. It is counterproductive, it is destructive, and it is harmful. And it has hurt children for a long time. As a licensed daycare provider, I am responsible to be a mandated reporter for child abuse. What about a child who is abusive for himself, to himself and others? This is also at-risk behavior that affects more than a child. A child who is HIV positive and a child who is having sex illicitly and a child who continues to infect others needs the intervention of their parents. Laws are often made because we make assumptions. To assume that a majority of parents don't care, are not in touch, and aren't able to guide their children is wrong. This is not a case of misconceptions or misemotions or miscommunication. This is wrong. To tell me that when these children have babies, 3 of my nieces that had babies, once they were pregnant, the clinic cut them loose. They had to come back to my sisters. One does not have health care and had to get on welfare because her insurance would not recognize the child of my sister's child as a bona fide dependent. Therefore, she had to get on AFDC to get the child help. My other sister, who was able to pay for her child's health care, now is responsible because somebody else gave a child an option, but she did not. To make assumptions, to tell kids don't have sex, but if you decide to have sex, come over here and get this without your parents, is giving them a mixed message that even adults would have a difficult time with. You've had plenty of opportunity to do this. We need to change this. We need your support to protect and correct our children when they fall. Please help us do this tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Banks? I don't think so. Nobody wants to ask you a question. But thank you for coming. Our next testifier is Dr. Olbert, but before, while you're coming down, you may come down, I do have some business to attend to. Upon consultation with the chair of the Civil Law Committee, it's my understanding that House Bill 2537 needs to go to Civil Law. And so at this point, I would like to reconsider the motion on House Bill 2537 that sent it to the General Register, and I'm glad we can do that in today's business. Is there any discussion about reconsidering the motion? We need to vote first to reconsider. All those in favor of reconsidering that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The motion has been reconsidered, and now I would like to re-refer House Bill 2537, that it would be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, members, for tolerating that. And good afternoon. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, good evening. My name is Dr. Charles Olbert, Madam Chair.
and I've been practicing pediatrics for 20 years, and I have the privilege to serve as the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics Minnesota chapter, and I'm speaking on your behalf tonight, as well as the Minnesota Medical Association, which represents 9,000 physicians and medical students and residents throughout the state. Before I give my testimony, I really do want to concur with Representative Bradley and say that we should really applaud the three adolescent teenagers who were here. The courage that they showed to give their stories, I really think, needs to be honored, and I think we were all moved by that testimony, as well as the testimony of Ms. Eubanks. And I also want to thank Representative Wilkin for continuing this dialogue. This is a very, very important dialogue that we need to discuss and continue to try to hash out. I was initially going to just cover some of the provisions of the law, but I think everybody at the table and everybody in the audience is aware of the things that are covered and aren't covered by the minor's consent law that's been in place since 1971. And I was going to say that I really felt that the statute has worked for over 30 years and it remains critical today, because as critical today as it was when it was first enacted, because it does provide a way for teens in risky situations to access care and to seek out knowledgeable adults. I'm going to actually speak from a provider perspective as a pediatrician, because I think that's maybe a perspective that hasn't been heard quite this evening. I also concur completely with Dr. Collette that the role of parents is really imperative. And I would say most of the time adolescents actually do inform their parents and frequently bring their parents to the healthcare setting when sensitive healthcare issues are going to be discussed. As a pediatrician who sees both children and adolescents, I welcome parents to come in when adolescents are seeking healthcare. I embrace parental involvement. And when I see a teen who comes in without a parent, one of the first questions that I ask them is, do your parents know that you're here today without their consent? And if the answer is no, I will frequently speak with them for a while to see if I could get their permission actually to contact their parent. Because, again, I think it's very important that parents are involved in the care of their children. And this frequently does open the door for making parents aware and allows an opportunity to solicit parental input when you might not have it otherwise. We really do try to, on a day-to-day basis, try to build a stronger relationship with parents. At least I do, and the colleagues that I work with, and it's really embraced by the American Academy of Pediatrics. My concern is about minors who are not in healthy relationships with their parents. How are we supposed to handle that situation? Where there may be no relationship whatsoever, where the adolescent might be out on the streets or may be homeless, or actually may just come from an unsafe environment where even discussing the issue of seeking care might put those teens in jeopardy. This law allows us to see those children, to see those adolescents, and then try to start to re-help establish a relationship with their parents. You also know that the current minor consent law requires parental involvement if maintaining confidentiality would jeopardize the minor's health, and we've heard that again this evening. And I must say, as a provider, as a pediatrician, and my other colleagues, we take that provision very, very seriously, and if we really do feel that an adolescent's health is in danger, we will supersede their confidentiality and will, in fact, seek parental input at that point. Now, you've heard a lot of statistics this evening. I'm just going to give you four percentages to show that teens do, in fact, engage in risky behavior. I probably don't need to do this. But first, 16% of ninth graders report using marijuana in the past 30 days. 7% of ninth graders actually report trying to commit suicide in the past year. Again, confirming some of those issues and topics that Dr. Collette made reference to. 34% of Minnesota seniors in high school report binge drinking in the past 2 weeks. I mean, that just blew me away to think that our teenager adolescents who are in senior high school, that 34% might be binging in the last 2 weeks. That's just a really striking type of statistics. And 40% actually report having more than one sexual partner. Now, the argument that's been made up to tonight is, it seems that they've taken correlational data and then used it to somehow blame the minor's consent law for the reason that we have these statistics. And yet, I didn't hear anybody, even including Dr. Collette, who has some very fine data, actually demonstrate some causation between these risky trends that we're seeing and the fact that it's somehow related to the minor consent law. And I would say, I would just concur with what we heard earlier, that there is data that shows that if we actually take the confidentiality away, the adverse risky behaviors will continue, but the adolescents will start not seeking care, which just puts the situation in even more of a risky type of situation. So in conclusion, I think there is a need to make sure teens continue to have access to confidential care. I think it's imperative that we respect that confidentiality. I understand your concerns that minor's consent raises. And as a pediatrician as a father of two daughters, 116 and 121, I know firsthand the very delicate balance between confidential care and my parental right to know. On the other hand, I feel that this statute actually provides this balance, and I would urge you not to support this legislation. It's important for our teens to continue to be able to seek care when they feel they need to. We will continue to seek parental involvement, and with that, I thank you very much for the opportunity to get some comments and would be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Oliver, there seems to be a kind of an underlying assumption, which I thought the young people particularly, but even goes further, seems to be in conflict. And that is that because providers are professionals, they do everything right, and because parents are human, they make a lot of mistakes. And yet we heard tonight providers making horrendous mistakes. And I don't know why we would consider them as being more infallible than parents who have, even in almost the worst circumstances, have a love relationship. So help me understand how we can assume from what you're saying that all providers are going to be as perfect as you say you may be in your practice, which is fine. But we heard these three examples, and I know of many others, where providers make worse mistakes.
Yeah, I would just, a couple comments. One,
Dr. Oliver.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would very much like to reaffirm Ms. Eubanks' comments. I agree with her completely. Nobody knows and nobody loves her children more than their parents. I've seen this for 20 years as a pediatrician, as a healthcare provider. On the other hand, there are times when adolescents find themselves in risky situations where they really are frightened to go in and have a conversation, especially those most vulnerable youth, where in fact, again, they may be out in the street or really do have an unhealthy relationship with their parent. This law allows us the opportunity to start the initial assessment and then try to find ways to re-bridge and reconnect. I can't speak to the situations that the adolescents had. I wish that we didn't hear from their providers. We heard their perceptions of the clinics and what their providers say. And, again, I honor their testimony. I thought it was very heartfelt and very well stated. On the other hand, I can only speak for the position of the American Academy of Pediatrics and my colleagues that are specialists in adolescent care, where that just would not be the typical response that you would find.
Representative
Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One follow-up. You've more than once referred to risky situations. I think others have referred to dysfunctional. Can you give me a percentage? I mean, what as a families in the public, what percentage of families do you think are so dysfunctional that we ought to have this kind of wedge between the children and their parents?
That's a wonderful question. And actually, I don't have the answer for that. It was probably, I think, for me, the most provocative comment that Dr. Collette made, which is, again, what is the role of public policy, and do you create policy for the concerns about the minority? I think that this issue is much broader than that issue. I guess my question back to you would be, how often do we have any data to actually demonstrate that, in fact, the vast majority of teens who are seeking care aren't including their parents? I would argue that, in fact, they are, that the majority of times, the adolescents, when they seek care, are either the parents either know ahead of time or in a very short time after the care has been received that they eventually develop confidence, frequently with the help of the healthcare providers, to actually make that connection. And it's kind of the corollary of your question. I think your question is very good. I'd like to see the other percentage, which is what percent aren't actually confiding in their parents at the present time.
Dr. Oberg, you mentioned that you try to contact parents or encourage minors to contact their parents by persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
But actually the legislation here is not about necessarily contacting parents. It's about just allowing parents to have access to those medical records. Do you have objections with having parents receive medical records or at least view them?
Well, in the context of the present law, again, I've been able to work in the present situation well for 20 years. I've not found it to be an impediment. And again, I've always tried to encourage parental involvement. I guess my biggest concern would be from the research that we've seen from the American Medical Association and JAMA and some of those other articles, where by removing that confidentiality, we actually will defer adolescents from seeking care. And that would be my biggest concern, that the risky behavior or the dysfunctional behavior would continue, but the adolescents would actually stop or deter or defer care that might get them into the system a little bit sooner.
So, Dr. Olberg, you don't have the position that those studies were not as thorough as was described earlier by Professor Collette?
No, I would concur with her observations about the study and the fact that they were surveys, and I think we'll hear a little bit later from one of the other presenters about some other research that's been done that would help to either complement or refute some of those pieces.
Thank you. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Olberg, I just want to make sure I understood a bit of your testimony. You said if a child's health is endangered in any way that you normally would want to go to the parents anyway. Is that true?
That's
Dr.
right.
Dr. Olberg.
Oh, Madam Chair, yes. Thank you. That's right. That's correct.
Okay. And then, but
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But given the explosion we've had with STDs and teen pregnancies, my question is, isn't teen sexual activity a danger to their health by definition?
Dr. Olberg.
Madam Chair and Representative Paul, I would agree. And again, as I mentioned in my testimony, I would say that the first question that I ask when I'm interviewing a teen is, do your parents know you're here? And if the answer is no, do you mind if I contact them? And I would say in the majority of time, I can't give you a percentage, the majority of time after some dialogue and discussion that I'm able to contact the parents and at least provide them the information that the adolescent was there and was seeking care. And at that point, you just open the door and hope that you can foster a relationship between the parent and the adolescent.
Thank you.
But I would not disagree with you at all about the importance of STD in the present society.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
Our next testifier is Dr. Chris Reif. I hope I'm saying that right. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. Thank you for inviting me to speak to your committee on this topic that is very important to me, teen health and minor consent. My name is Dr. Christopher Reif, and I've come here to share with you my personal experience of being a physician for the last 25 years. I don't represent any organization here before you, my own experience. I grew up in St. Cloud, graduated from St. John's, then the University of Minnesota, and then I did my residency at Hennepin County Medical Center. I've been a family practitioner in the Twin Cities for 25 years, and currently I practice at a clinic in Richfield. We have a very busy family medicine clinic there. We see many ages. We see people from all different cultural backgrounds. And I see many teenagers at our clinic, usually with their parents, but sometimes I see them alone. For me, seeing parents with their teens is what works best. As a family doctor, I know that solid parental support is the most important ingredient for healthy teenagers. So when I get to see parents and teens together, I get to be part of their health team. We can talk about important health issues. I ask them, so do you and your mom talk about growing up? What do your parents say about smoking? What do they say about alcohol? And I ask the parents, what have you discussed so far with your children about sexuality? Are there any questions that I could help you with? I'm also glad to see teenagers by themselves if they come to my clinic. I know that they have something important on their minds, and I know that I will have a chance to have a positive influence on them. If teens come in to see me on their own, I always ask them, so, do your parents know that you're here? How are you getting along with your parents? Can you talk to them about this problem? Are there any other adults that you can talk to? There are different reasons why teens come in to see me on their own. Sometimes their parents are at work, or out of town, or living in another city, or maybe they are living on their own. Sometimes the teens are too shy or embarrassed to talk to their parents. In some cultures and in some families, it's considered impolite to talk about sensitive or personal issues with your parents. Sometimes the teens have done something that they know their parents will disapprove of, and they are afraid to tell them. Or sometimes they come from a broken home where the parents might be drinking or abusive, or it would be trouble. Sometimes the teenager has run away. Let me tell you two stories about teens who recently came to my clinic and have changed their names to protect their privacy. Maria is a 17-year-old who came in because she thought she might be pregnant and also have an infection. She was afraid to tell her parents because, as she said, her dad really hates her boyfriend. I was concerned about her health and the health of her baby if she were pregnant. So I did an exam and ordered tests, and it turned out she was pregnant and had an infection. She was only a little surprised that she was pregnant, and she said that she wanted to have a healthy baby. I prescribed prenatal vitamins and medicine for her infection, and I talked to her about how she would let her family know. She decided that it would be easiest to talk to her sister first, then her mother, and probably finally her dad. I told her I respected her good sense and concern she was showing towards her health and that of her baby, so she left the office a little bit less shocked and a little bit more relieved. Another teenager, James, came in because he had a rash down there. In health class that day, they had learned about STDs, and he was scared. He didn't really want to talk to me about how he got the rash, but he agreed to be tested for HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. His parents were recently separated. He lives with his mom, and his dad lives in a different city. He really didn't want to talk to his mom about this right now. I did the test, prescribed medicine for him, and we talked about ways to prevent infection. I mentioned abstinence and using protection. Also, I suspected that alcohol may have been involved in his weekend encounter. He agreed to come back to go over the tests, talk more about healthy choices, and I made a note to talk to him about drug use. I told him that I was glad that he came in to see me and that we would take this one step at a time. I was able to take care of both of these teenagers because of minor consent and teen confidentiality. As it turns out, these laws are some of the most useful tools that I now carry in my black teen doctor bag. These laws are so important that I always explain minor consent and confidentiality to teens and their parents on the first visit to my clinic. This often happens when they come in for their sixth or seventh grade physical. And I tell them, confidentiality means that whatever you tell me, what you want, I won't tell anyone if you don't want me to. Unless, of course, I think that it is dangerous, and then we will need to tell your parents. I want to protect your health and keep you healthy. I then ask both the teen and the parents if they understand and if they think that's okay with them. Almost always, except once or twice a year, I hear back from the parents, and they say, that's fine. I think this works because most parents understand that I'm committed to what's best for their children. They trust me. They appreciate that I share a deep concern for the well-being of their kids. I am very careful with this trust. I know it is trust that keeps kids connected to their parents. I know it is trust that keeps families connected to their doctor. I know about teens and trust from being a parent, too. We have four children and three teenagers, ages 18, 16, 12, and 9. I know my children get mixed messages from the media about alcohol, smoking, dating, sex, and what it means to be cool. I do my best to talk to them about making the right moral and health decisions. I try to be available if they have any questions. And we do talk, sometimes. And sometimes they talk to others. I recall when my son was 15, and I took him to see his doctor for a ninth grade checkup. He was in the room for a full 30 minutes, and while I fidgeted in the waiting room, he came out and I finally said, "So son, what did you and Dr. Johnson talk about for all that time?" And he looked at me straight and he said, "You know, Dad, that's private. I guess you'll just have to trust me." And so, minor consent, I feel, is important for all of us to do this work with teens. We physicians need it to provide the best health care. We parents need it to be partners in trust with our physicians. And each of our children needs it to be sure they have another adult to talk to in these times of need. I hope these stories from a doctor's point of view help you understand the importance of minor consent and confidentiality. I hope that now it is clear what you can do to help. Please keep minor consent and confidentiality legal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Representative Paul.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I heard it again. I'm going to ask again. You said the same thing that the testifier before. If you felt that the child was in danger, you would circumvent, now I don't want to put words in your mouth, you tell me, you would circumvent this law and go to the parents. Is that what you said?
Dr. Reif.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I would use the law, because the law has a provision in it that says that if I feel the child is in danger, I then can break confidentiality and speak to the parents. So I would be using the law. And I would tell the child, I would say, I'm concerned here, as I have done on several occasions, and said, you know, this is a dangerous situation here, and we need to get your parents involved. What's the best way to do that?
And Madam Chair, follow-up. Again, with the explosion of STDs and teen pregnancies, aren't they endangered by definition by the sexual activity?
Dr. Rife.
Thank you very much. From what I know, I've seen a lot of sex that has gone on between teenagers that has ended up giving them infections or giving them pregnancies when they've not needed it. At other times, I've seen them be sexually involved, and they've been able to avoid infections and avoid pregnancy.
One more thought. Wasn't it true that one of the biggest increases we're seeing is increases in cervical cancer, and we're seeing that in young adults because of sexual activity? Now, I would think that that would constitute a danger to the child's health, and something that, given your testimony, you'd said that you would want to contact the parents about.
Dr. Rife.
Appreciate that. And so that's why I'm very careful, too, in screening all of the kids that I see to be sure I can tell them whether or not they've been exposed to STDs or abnormal pap smears. So I really do try to give all the kids that I see the best health care so I can let them know whether or not they're in danger.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Ray, first of all, I mean, I compliment you in what you say about your practice. It seems like a caring practice that does try to be respectful. But we're dealing with a law here that has much broader implications than just an individual practitioner and that kind of respect.
Yes.
It seems one of the dilemmas, because even you said you're asking the team for judgment, and yet it seems like the circumstances are often where already the teen has shown a propensity for some bad judgment. And now you're going to trust their judgment in terms of whether or not their parents ought to be involved. Isn't there a contradiction there?
Dr. Wright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I said, I don't trust their judgment all the way. So if I really think that they're making bad decisions that endanger their health, I tell them, we need to get your parents involved.
Representative Bradley.
But Madam Chair, Doctor, it seems like unless you believe that there's real danger, that you're constrained by the law in terms of informing parents. You could try to coach them, but if those teens, and I think if I heard the three young ladies who just spoke to us, I think every one of them was admitting at the time that they were making bad judgments. I mean, that's what I sort of heard them say, which is probably not unusual. I'm not sure. Isn't the law going to get in the way? Because if you don't think that they're in danger, you just think it would be wrong for them, they can say, nope, I don't want my parents to be aware.
Dr. Rife.
So I think that I have seen a lot of kids that have been in trouble that I've helped by calling that, by saying, I think you're really in trouble. I think you're using too much drugs. I think that you're being exposed to very much dangerous sexual activity. We need to get your parents involved. So I would like to tell a story about providers that I think by being concerned, by being engaged, by dealing with these teenagers, actually get them care that they need and they wouldn't have had otherwise. So I think that's a very good story that you all should know about providers out there who are using this law to be involved with the kids, and also to being involved with the parents when we need to be.
But Dr. Rife, despite your encouragement to get the parents involved, the law says they don't have to get the parents involved if they don't want to. Correct?
The law also says that if I think that it's dangerous, I involve the parents. It is not the choice now of the child.
And what is the definition of dangerous, Dr. Wright?
And thank you. So this is what I use for my training, and that's why for all of the training that I've had, I am very careful when I see a child that's involved in something that's dangerous, whether it's drugs, whether it's sexual activity, whether it's something around violence at home or in the school, I tell them that. I am concerned about your health and well-being. We need to get your parents involved. And I have support in my office. I have support from my staff. We have done many interventions on kids that have been near that edge, and I'm worried about them. And I think we've had good success stories of getting the parents, having a sit-down, having a talk about what's going on with their children. The parents have been grateful to us. And I think that the system worked very well because the kids came in, the kids knew and thought they were going to get good treatment. They did. We saw that they were in trouble. We got the parents together, and there was a good conversation that happened.
So, Dr. Reif, the law is essentially subjective, then. You can determine if you think it's dangerous. Then it would be your opinion whether or not the behavior is dangerous or not. And it could differ from a parent's opinion or a minor's opinion.
Well, again, this is what much of my medical training has been about, whether I'm working in the area of cardiology or adolescent health, is to look for those signs of danger and to look for when somebody's in trouble. And I really feel that I apply that same high standards of professional care to adolescents as I do to somebody who's having a heart attack or a stroke.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Michelle. Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. Again, my name is Michelle Van Branken, and I'm a family practice physician. I'm currently the medical director of two adolescent clinics, one in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, called the Annex Teen Clinic, and one in Excelsior, Minnesota, called West Suburban Teen Clinic. As the current director of these two clinics that serve primarily teens and young adults, both in Robbinsdale and Excelsior, I'm hoping that you will consider not sending forward this bill that would remove a young person's ability to confidentially access the healthcare system in certain situations. There are many, many misperceptions, and a lot of them have come up today, a lot of fears around this issue. And what I'm afraid is that this bill would allow these fears and misperceptions to guide our policymaking instead of using some sound medical practice. There is a misperception that by allowing teens to access clinical services confidentially, the lines of communication between a child and parent are removed. The reality is that both I and the staff that I work with believe in the importance of both parents and the community in a young person's life. If I could give you some examples, we have health educators that provide presentations specifically just to parents of teenagers and young adults on how to keep these lines of communication open during a time in their life when one of their main tasks is actually to become more independent from their parents. Our health educators also provide seminars that include both mothers and daughters together with the goal of helping each understand what the other is experiencing during this very important developmental period for them. I've personally answered phone calls when parents were concerned and upset, and when I didn't feel like I could it was a situation to bring confidentiality, I felt very comfortable inviting the parent to the clinic, asking the parent to come to the clinic with their teen so that we could start fostering this communication. I understand that there were some other experiences, but I can tell you that hasn't happened for me, and it's expected at the clinics that I work at that it won't happen there as well. When this bill was put forward, and I don't know if it was this committee in particular, I sent letters specifically inviting everybody to our clinic, come and see what we do. We are not trying to turn parents away. And unfortunately, I got no takers from this invitation. And I can tell you that I've personally, on many occasions, encouraged a young person to continue pursuing conversations with their parents when I hear from them, I can't talk to my parents, or they just don't understand. If I believe that just telling teens to talk to their parents, if I believe that that was enough and not, and that they would just do this, and if I believe that teens and young adults would then follow up these conversations by only making those decisions that either their parents or even myself hope that they would make, I wouldn't feel the need to be sitting here with you today. Instead, I know from experience that, and from what the teens tell us in clinics, what they tell us in surveys, what we see in studies, that teens and young adults do not always make the choices and decisions we hope that they will make. This is sometimes frustrating, it's sometimes even rewarding, but it's always an essential piece for their task of becoming adults. It occurs at every clinical site that I work at, whether this be in Minneapolis, in the north side of town in Robbinsdale, or even out west towards Excelsior. And as they make these other choices, it's critical that they have certain information and services available to them. By removing the ability for these teens to access certain healthcare services, we remove a safety net that exists. This leads me to my second misperception concerning the services our clinics provide to teens. It's also incredibly disheartening to continue to hear comments, for example, that by providing reproductive services to young women, we are encouraging them to be sexually active. This comment recurs despite solid data that providing information does not change the mind of young men and women who choose to remain abstinent. Providing this information and access, though, does increase the use of these services by those youth that are choosing otherwise. These comments also recur despite good data that young men and women would be less likely to utilize clinical services if they could not be obtained confidentially. Unfortunately, not utilizing clinical services is not necessarily followed by a change in behavior or choice, and we've heard that a few times this evening. Clearly, it's a dangerous combination when we remove the ability of our youth to access the services that they're telling us they need. Finally, it's easy to forget that when we are talking about allowing youth in the community to access these services, we're not just referring to family planning services. We're referring to the ability of teens to receive services and information related to prenatal care, to chemical dependency, to the treatment of sexually transmitted diseases, and to some mental health concerns. And our hope is that it will act as a door to initially get some services needed so they won't be delayed, and in the process encourage parents to be involved. It would be a terrible disservice for a teen not to receive early prenatal care because she was still too scared to tell her parents about the pregnancy. And it would be a terrible disservice for a young man to not have an infection treated because he was still struggling with how to explain the symptoms he was having to his family. I'm asking you to help our clinics provide these early prenatal services while at the same time encouraging them to reach to their family for support. I am asking you to help us to provide early diagnosis and effective treatment of sexually transmitted diseases while still guiding a young person and how to bring this sensitive topic home. I hope that you will help us to provide these essential services in our community by not supporting the legislation that is before us.
Thank you. The next testifier, thank you for coming. Appreciate it. Professor Maggie. Good evening.
Good evening. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak here tonight. My name is Dr. Margaret Dexheimer-Ferris. I'm a nurse, and I teach in the graduate program and baccalaureate nursing program at the College of St. Catherine. I also do emergency nursing at Hennepin County Medical Center's Emergency Department, and I'm a mother of four. My area of expertise is responding to teenage victims of trauma. This evening, I'm here representing my professional organization, the Minnesota Nurses Association. I'm speaking in opposition to House File 352. I would like to tell you about my practice with teens, most of whom are doing well and are connected with their families. Prior to coming to the College of St. Catherine to teach in the year 2000, I worked for 10 years as a sexual assault nurse examiner for Hennepin County. We responded to 7 hospital emergency departments whenever someone presented after being sexually assaulted. The population most at risk for sexual assault is teenagers. Only 5% of teens report the assault to law enforcement. Teens are usually assaulted by someone they know. The most typical scenario is that a teen says goodbye to her parents on a Friday evening. She goes with friends to a movie and somehow ends up at a party instead. Some sweet-talking young man, or maybe man, then gets the girl alone, and the encounter turns forceful, and he rapes her. She uses all of the coping mechanisms that she has, which for teenagers is simply denial. She does not fight. She does not call the police. She does not tell her parents. She's terrified of how they will react. She doesn't want to hurt her parents or to let them down. Instead, she goes home, she goes straight to her room, she listens to music, she tells her mother she's not hungry, she's sick. And then on Monday, when she goes to school and tells her best friend as she breaks down crying, she says she's terrified that she has a sexually transmitted disease, maybe AIDS. She feels deformed and depressed. 1 out of 10 teenagers who have been sexually assaulted attempt suicide. This is no time to leave them at home alone with their pain. The friend knows she can be seen confidentially at the emergency department or at the clinic, and she talks her into going. That's where I come in. I see this very sad, dejected teen looking down at the floor. I immediately know the story, but I listen carefully to what she has experienced. She tells me I can't call her mom because she's sure that her mother is going to kill her. If she knew I was at that party, she'd never speak to me again. I use a little more time to build a relationship and trust. Here is where the minor consent laws come into play. They buy us time to build a relationship with kids and bring their families in a helpful way. I can then say, look, you've just been sexually assaulted and you deserve to have a parent's support and love. I'm very good at helping parents understand how to be helpful to you. I'm going to call them and I will help them understand how to support you. And I do, and I have, hundreds of times. Without the ability to see youth confidentially, they will silently try to cope with these huge issues alone. The result is depression, sudden decrease in school grades, often shoplifting as a sign for help, a loss of sexual boundaries, decreased self-esteem, untreated sexually transmitted infections, possibly suicide. Since the time when the minor consent statute was initiated, much has changed. The environment many youth have found themselves in is more dangerous, and parents are more important to teens. Ironically, this makes minor consent much more important today than it was in 1971. Kids are terrified of disappointing their parents, and they are fearful of causing their parents pain. They avoid letting their parents down at all costs. That cost may be a sexually transmitted disease resulting in sterility. The cost may be drug use resulting in injury, or the cost may be an untreated sexual assault resulting in the teen suddenly becoming a shell of his or her former self without parents even knowing or being able to help. When teens venture into harm's way, they need to be able to access help. Another example, a few years ago I was at a suburban hospital emergency department doing an exam on a teenager and working with her parents on how to assure her healing. When I was paged by an ER social worker from another suburban hospital, he explained that he had a 13-year-old who came in with a 16-year-old boyfriend whom she said she was living with. The story was that she had been gang raped at gunpoint the night before. The social worker told me the teen would not give her consent to inform her parents, and she wouldn't give her information, contact information on the parents, and that she just wanted to make sure that she was all right down there. I told him I would be right there to see her. By the time I got there, 30 minutes later, the teen was gone. The hospital social worker had put her on the phone with the hospital attorney to explain why they needed parental consent, and she ran out of the hospital. She was on her own after this huge trauma. Not understanding the current law, the social worker acted as he would have to if House File 352 were to pass. So instead of having access to a caring nurse who could listen to her story, her whole story, and treat her prophylactically for sexually transmitted infections and help her see that she is cared for and her issues with her parents are addressed, this child was on her own. The trajectory for this teen and the many others who will not get care of House File 352 is passed is going to bring great social costs. House File 352 is not good legislation. Ironically, it may just most harm the children of the very people who are supporting it. They will wish that their children could have access to caring and competent nurse or physician. Think carefully about this issue. If in the past some youth have accessed care for something that they should have, that should have involved their parents, and these three young women have testified powerfully, I honor that testimony. If indeed they sat down with those providers and said, yes, I'm using drugs, I'm having sex with a number of people, and those providers did nothing, it's a practice issue. This is not a legal issue. Don't solve it with a law. Providers, as we teach them, and I have taught physicians and nurses, that they need to know when to bring in parents and know when to break confidence and know when danger does indeed occur. This is not a legislative issue. It's a professional practice issue. Please do not jeopardize the health of thousands of teens for the sake of these few cases. It's poor policy. I strongly encourage you to stop this bill from going forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this very important issue.
Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. You just mentioned that the providers know when to tell the parents and when not to. Of the all the people that are seen, of all the teenagers that are seen, how many are referred back to their parents?
Professor. Madam Chair, Representative Samuelson, in my practice in 10 years, I think there were two children or teenagers that would not give me their parents' numbers. I gave them my pager number and told them to page me at 8:30 in the morning and 8:30 at night every day until I knew a parent was involved. I want to speak to Representative Powell's questions as well as yours. I think that I would hope that all things would have worked out well for these three young women. But had they not been able to access that clinic, even if those providers didn't do a full screen and involve parents, they may have been pregnant. They may have gotten pelvic inflammatory disease and been sterile by now. Other bad things could have happened. We would love to solve this problem of kids getting into problems. This bill is not the way to solve it. We need to solve it by helping parents connect with their teens. Those three young women were not able to talk to their parents. They were not able to talk to their parents. Oh, that I wish that somebody at Planned Parenthood could have made that happen. I don't know that they could have. At least they did not get a sexually transmitted disease and are not sterile from untreated pelvic inflammatory disease. I'm sorry for what happened to the three of you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, you used a logic which I would like to sort of turn another way. Your logic was just because there's some providers that didn't do the right thing, we shouldn't change the law. But couldn't I also say just because there are some parents that maybe dysfunctional family or something, why would we penalize the 90-95% or the rest of the families who are perfectly capable? And as a matter of fact, this kind of wedge is dysfunction. It helps create dysfunctionality.
Professor, Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, it is not just the dysfunctional families that we're talking about here. All of the patients, most of the patients I'm talking about, came from solid families, parents who loved those children, but they just could not tell their parents, Mom, I've been raped. Mom, I'm sexually active. And that's where at least we can provide some care. I ask your trust in the medical profession and in the nursing profession that we would be able to serve children and serve families well. I think the vast majority of practitioners are doing that. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only response is, why would I trust the provider community any more than I would trust parents?
Seeing no other questions, thank you for your testimony.
Do I get to answer the question?
Oh, sure, if you'd like to.
Madam Chair, I think that parents are absolutely the most important forces in children's life, and certainly we recognize that within the healthcare industry, and I understand that you do also. There's no reason.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Scott Harpin. Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Scott Harpin. I'm a public health nurse that works at St. Joseph's Home for Children in South Minneapolis, which is a division of Catholic Charities Minneapolis-St. Paul. I'm here to talk about how the mature minor legislation is used in our agency and ask you to keep those accompanying statutes intact as they exist. St. Joe's is one of a very few number of sites in Minnesota that entirely serves youth and out-of-home placements. Besides serving as a temporary home for Hennepin County children residing in foster care, we are also home to youth from across Minnesota, Red Wing, Fergus Falls, Wilmer, Owatonna, all who may reside in our residential treatment facility. Our community health clinic is often a gateway into health care for children and teens who have had marginal and incomplete care in the past. In practice, the mature minor statutes allow we nurses and pediatricians to decide which youth are able to consent to their own medical treatment. This is important for our population of youth because their parents or guardian are often unavailable to us or the youth. A great majority of our youth are in child protection and thus often have no contact orders keeping the parents and their children from even saying hello or I love you to one another. Our hands are tied as we are often unable to contact parents to include them into the care of their children due to child protection orders. Still, we would like to. We also serve homeless youth in our clinic, one staying at an on-site shelter. These youth, who are often estranged from parents, are the ones with the greatest barrier to parental consent. Would changes to this minor consent law leave them only to rely on emergency care instead of preventative clinic visits? We make great efforts to contact the parents and involve them in the care of their child. Often, we may treat a child for a condition without a parent's consent, only to receive a gracious thank you from the parent after their child is released back into their custody. In many cases, we have diagnosed and treated conditions that would have gone untreated without our intervention. Thus, we are bridging a care gap for for the parents who are then able to continue treatment started by us while they're in child protection. In our clinic, traditional arguments against minor consent don't apply. First, the parents are unable to join the child in our clinic. If a child is seen in a traditional pediatric clinic, mom can come to the admission window with the child, signs the paperwork, waits in the waiting room with her child until they are called. At St. Joe's, the parent may be court-ordered to stay away from their child, might be in corrections, maybe in detox, or even crisis. Second, our community health clinic is bound by Catholic social teaching to refrain from any family planning or contraception education to our youth. We are not counseling youth about birth control options or ordering contraception for youth. Thus, our main goal is to identify and treat medical conditions by empowering the youth to appropriately access health care. This happens by explaining mature minor concepts at every visit with an adolescent who can developmentally consent to treatment. Our hopes are that youth will remember their experience at our clinic, return for care, and feel comfortable enough to bring their parents along next time so that we can include them in their visit. We certainly encourage them to bring their parent if possible. I'm again asking you to keep the mature minor statutes intact as they were written 30 years ago. Taking away the option for youth to consent to care will make it only more difficult to do my job in the clinic. An act as simple as repealing 3441 will take away precious opportunity to educate and prevent hepatitis B risks. As a public health nurse working directly with youth who have already known very tough times, I want to be sure that I'm able to continue providing health care they need and do whatever I can to help these teens reconnect with their families. Please leave the statutes intact. Thank you very much for your consideration and time.
Any questions? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hoffman, you seem to have used, if I heard you right, the logic that says that we have homeless or we can't reach families or dysfunctional. Let me suggest, I mean, what if we put that aside? Now, what about the families that are functional? And what about this law as it affects the relationship there? Because those are the exceptions. That's not the norm, I don't think, in our society at all. And what we have to think as policymakers is the broader picture. Why can't we, instead of telling all families that you don't have the right to access the medical information about your child, why can't we define it in a way that if there are those circumstances where there is not contact or there is danger or other kind of things, why can't we define it that way instead?
Mr. Harbin.
Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, thank you for that question. I guess it's first important to realize that dysfunctional families are often very functional also, especially in this situation. Many of my kids have very amazing ties to their families and just are temporarily away from them for child protection reasons. So a lot of times the kids that I see are in contact with their parents and don't have these same concerns that we've been discussing tonight. It seems like, to answer your question, it's almost a double standard to say you're in child protection, you can come and see doctors in our clinic, but yet once you are released back to your parents, you can not see a doctor out there and consent to care. The statute 3341 will allow us, the kids that are away from their parents, to continue seeing us, but it's just a double standard for them not to.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Harkin, I'm not at all suggesting that people shouldn't be able to see. I'm just suggesting that in the regular families, why shouldn't the family be a part of that? I mean, they're still able to see. The whole question is not about being able to seek it. It's about whether or not the parents are allowed to be involved and be informed.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
There's someone here from the university. Good evening.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, Director of Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota, a member of the Public Health and Preventive Medicine Committee of the Minnesota Medical Association, and past president of the Minnesota Public Health Association. Today, however, I'm speaking on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Michael Resnick, who was scheduled to speak, but because of a family emergency and a medical problem, asked me to step in for him and relay some of the information that he was going to present. Dr. Resnick is Professor of Pediatrics and Public Health at the University of Minnesota. He directs the National Teen Pregnancy Prevention Research Center, a center of adolescent health research and training funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For 27 years, Dr. Resnick has conducted research on resiliency and protective factors in the lives of youth. That is, he looks at the opportunities, resources, and supports that young people need to develop in a healthy way. He also has done work around the theme of connectedness, the importance of feeling connected to parents, family, school, and other adults. Such connectedness reduces involvement in serious, risky behaviors such as violence, suicide, early sexual activity, and substance abuse. Dr. Resnick's research has clearly identified the critical role of caring, competent adults in the lives of children. His work is of such stature that the previous and current White House administrations have used his findings to help guide national policy on youth health and development. In Dr. Resnick's well-researched opinion, and from my perspective as a pediatric and young adult practitioner, some proponents of this legislation are clinging to a few assumptions that simply are not true. So with respect to differences of opinion, several pertinent, well-researched scientific conclusions that are not grounded in opinion, but carefully verified fact will be shared. The first comes from the frequently asked question, does the availability of confidential services encourage substance abuse, teen pregnancy, and other risky behaviors? The answer is unequivocally no. In Minnesota, in the United States, and internationally, it has been scientifically documented that the option of seeking health services on a confidential basis does not increase adolescent participation in high-risk behaviors. This conclusion is based on research as well as studies, current research, and also on studies dating back to the 1970s. If you look at the areas of the country where adolescents have the most difficult access to confidential care, teen pregnancy and birth rates are among the highest in the nation. While lack of access to confidential care is not a cause of teen pregnancy in and of itself, similarly, assuring access to confidential services does not increase participation in risky behaviors. The data tell us that it's time to put this argument to rest. Secondly, proponents of this legislation claim that the ability to seek services on a confidential basis undermines parental authority and communication between parents and teens. How did they know this? What is the evidence? Dr. Resnick's team has looked at key indicators that speak directly to this in Minnesota and across the United States. The vast majority of young people report feeling close to and cared for by their parents. They identify parents and family as the key resources they would turn to for help with a variety of problems and concerns. When teens feel they can turn to their parents first, they do and they will. There is no evidence that the option of confidential health service undermines this sense of connectedness to parents and the parent-child communication. This is precisely why protection of confidentiality is the official position of organizing representing pediatrics, nursing, family practice, and adolescent health and medicine, organizations that also value and understand the primary role of parents and families in the lives of adolescents. Finally, it is important to know that the first quality that adolescents look for in health services is confidentiality that protects the patient-provider relationship. Without confidentiality, more than a quarter of teens indicate they will forego needed health care services, even at the risk to their own health. We also know that among health professionals who care for adolescents, the standard of care is to help reconnect young people if there is a disconnect with their families and with other caring adults. Statutes allowing minors access to essential health services without parental consent were implemented in Minnesota and throughout the country a generation ago because of rising concern about the health and risky behaviors of teens. These statutes were grounded in an understanding that the option of confidentiality helps get teens in the door so providers could ensure early diagnosis and treatment of a variety of health issues. The need for these statutes is still present today. Dr. Resnick, in asking me to do this, has stated, we ignore the scientific evidence on the importance of confidentiality at our own peril. As an adolescent health researcher who is fully committed to the importance of family connectedness, adult-teen communication, and the involvement of caring, competent adults in the lives of our children, I cannot help but oppose this legislation that flies in the face of what our young people need and what families want for their teenage sons and daughters, end quote. I share that opinion. Thank you. And I'll be open to any questions, and I'm sure Dr. Resnick would respond with any data that you might like about the issue of confidentiality and access to services, if I could get that information, if I'm not able to share that information with you.
Okay, any questions? Thank you. Thank you for coming and for presenting today. Rich Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Again, as a courtesy, I shared with Representative Wilkin my points of view, and we talked for a little bit here and there. Secondly, I just want, as a matter of clarification, so that I can appropriately testify, in regards to 144.341, when you're living apart from parents and managing financial affairs, would that section of the law is the way you have made the disconnect from two, does that law still apply where medical records of that individual would still be private and the parents would not have access, or has that changed?
Perhaps we could have House Research answer that question.
I'm not too clear, and I would make some remarks to that, but I'll continue on.
Unless Representative Wilkin, you want to get up in the chair and answer it. Okay. Ms. Benelli, is this your issue?
Madam Chair, members, 144.341 is not included in the bill, so it's not affected.
All right. Thank you very much, okay. Madam Chair. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. And for a great number of years, I've worked with young people through the Wilder Foundation. At the Union Gospel Mission, for 2 years, I worked with street kids who were living on the streets and needed various kinds of services. So I'm very familiar with these kinds of issues. And I just want to relate to of a story that I'm aware of a kid. This kid came from had a family with alcoholic background and dynamics. It was a situation where the kid couldn't really talk to his parents, particularly about these kinds of things. The kids, even to the point for a couple summers, didn't even stay at home. They knew that he was being taken care of, but the kid stayed at home for a couple summers. And that the kid remembered was when the birds and the bees kinds of questions came up. The dad was drunk and said to the kid, "Hey, I'm going to tell you about the birds and the bees." Secondly, one of the stories in the neighborhood that the kid was aware of is that if you wanted to get a condom, you go talk to Ed, who was about 14, 15 years old, and could easily get condoms from the top drawer of his mom's dresser cabinet, because that's where the live-in boyfriend kept them. But one of the things about it, that if you got them from Ed or someone, watch out for the pinholes, because that's the joke that I like to try to do. The third thing was that as the kid got older and learned about things through the health education classes that you folks and your previous folks made sure were taught, he had a question about sexually transmitted diseases. That kid then decided to take advantage of this law and never notified the parents. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that kid is me, who was a good kid then and is a good kid now and still does good service and all that. And, you know, it was just that I could not communicate with the parents at that time. They're both dead. But one of the things is that there are people who use these kinds of services and they're needed because of such of the dynamics or the situation in the home. I took advantage. Now, if you're in St. Paul in the late 60s, 70s, you saw the rash of the clinics. Now, it's not necessarily, you know, it seems like certain kinds of clinics are being harangued. And being harangued to the point that they throw out condoms and they do things like candy. I know that back when I was around, YES, Youth Emergency Service, the face-to-face, the helping hand, which is still on West 7th Street, provide clean, professional kinds of services. And I would oppose changing the law to where folks cannot get that service, young folks. Now, in the testimony that I've heard, one of the things that if you look at some other states, if you're wanting to change the law, some things you need to consider is as follows. First of all, as you know, there are federal laws that deal with Title X, which deal with family planning programs, federal confidentiality rules that deal with drug and alcohol programs, the Medicaid, and as you may know, with the new children's health initiatives that are happening over the years. They have stricter confidentiality rules They may have changed with HIPAA and things like that. I'm not aware of that. But they have had rules to where minors' privacy would be protected somewhat if you are a recipient of those federal monies. So depending on where you get the funding and depending on how this law goes, do you want to have that dual tier? Secondly, a number of states have adopted what they call a mature minor rule, which in the judgment of the professional who's accountable by license, if the minor is sufficiently intelligent and mature to understand the nature of consequences, and with the attempts to try and interact with parents and still cannot, they shall still be able to receive treatment without the consent of the parent, and there is still confidentiality. And number three, one of the things that I heard about was, well, where's the dad and things like that? And I just want to share with you some things in regards to that. And that's from the Journal of the American Medical Association, known as JAMA. In 1999, the Journal of the American Medical Association found that a significant percentage of teenagers had decided not to seek health care that they thought they needed due to confidentiality concerns. In a follow-up study with respect to reproductive health care specifically, a 2002 JAMA study found that almost half of sexually active teens visiting a family planning clinic would stop using clinic services if their parents were notified that they were seeking birth control, and another 11% reported that they would delay testing or treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, or HIV. Virtually all, 99%, however, reported that they would continue having sex. Madam Chair, in summary, I've shared with you, for me, I've been over here 2 decades plus, and there's a number of reasons why I lobby and all kinds of things. It could be based on principle. It could be, I just think, from what I hear of citizens. On this kind of thing, it's sort of on principle, but it's also a little personal kind of thing that, at least from my experience and where I've seen where a lot of kids are in situations that need this out sort of way with to be done in a safe, clean, licensed, professional way. And to the points to where there are folks that are handing and doing things like a candy store and not thinking about parent accountability and responsibility, I think a law can be shaped, if there's adamancy to do something about this, to make sure that all concerns are met. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, as all of you know, for those even those people that were just reelected, I am willing to help and to do anything, and I always come with a full amount of information. And I'm not I'm not against the Planned Parenthood. I'm not against the family council. I interact a lot with Tom Pritchard. Him and I, we work on a lot of issues. So whatever the perspective of view is coming from, I'm not taking one. I'm just trying to make sure there's good policy.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? I don't think so. Thank you. Representative Wilkin. Representative Wilkin, did you have some final comments? We do have some amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what we've heard from just about everybody is that parental involvement is important, but the opponents of the bill seem to think that providers should be trusted above parents. I've seen no evidence that that should be the case. We leave a lot to the provider's judgment in statute. The definition of danger is totally up to the provider. Their judgment and my judgment will often differ. There are situations where the multiple sexual transmitted diseases will do long-term harm to children, and that would, to me, constitute a danger. And most of the providers that are working in this area probably would come to a different judgment. It's we're all shaped by our values, and frankly, I don't agree with the values of the opponents. My feeling is we need to empower parents to take care of their responsibility for bringing up children and giving them guidance. Everyone is scared when they're a teen about talking about their faults, their problems with their parents. I was when I was a teen. I wasn't the saint that I am today.
We didn't know you were a saint today.
That was tongue-in-cheek, and I'm glad some people caught that. So I think it is important to get the parents involved in this. I ask for your support.
We have some amendments in front of us. Who would like to offer theirs first?
Yes, Madam Walker. Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I do that, if it's all right with you and the committee, I have a question for Representative Wilken.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wilken, my amendment, before I do that, let me ask. Your section on page 3, section 3, line 11, crossing out or has borne a child. I'm just trying to figure out the rationale behind that before I move my amendment.
Representative Wilken.
Chair Boudreau, Representative Walker, I looked at that. This was the initial draft of the legislation. I looked at your amendment. Frankly, I don't have any problem with your amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move H352A2, please.
Representative Walker moves A2, the A2 amendment.
Thank you. This amendment specifically strikes out the language that we just referred to on page 3, section 3, line 11. It puts it back in. And my rationale, just for the committee and those that are listening to understand, there's a couple of different situations. Once a young woman and a father bear a child, unfortunately, more often than not, they're no longer living with their parents at that time. And wanting to make sure that we encourage the new parents to taking control of their own children and getting the adequate medical that their children need.
Any discussion? Seeing none. Representative Wilken, would you like to incorporate that?
I'd incorporate it, or if you want to vote on it, whatever it takes.
I'll take the incorporation, Madam Chair.
Hey, okay.
I'll take the easy route.
Representative Wilken will incorporate the... Representative Lopez.
I don't think you can do it. I'm sorry.
Okay. I guess we can incorporate. Let's vote on it. Okay. A2 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Kamar, did you want to offer your amendment?
Madam Chair, I move H352A5.
Representative Paymar moves the A5 amendment. Representative Paymar.
This is a very straightforward amendment. It gives minors who have been the victim of incest the right to consent for health care services such as pregnancy-related services and treatment for drug and alcohol abuse and sexually transmitted diseases. The intent, I think, is clear. I don't think that we want to put children who are the victim of incest in the position of not being able to seek out medical care if they've been incested by a parent or a relative.
Representative Pena, I think if we could have House Research help us, I believe lines 15 through 18 are not necessary since we eliminated that part of the bill, but perhaps they could just, is that correct, Ms.
No.
Benelli? The A5 amendment, it refers to page 3, we just deleted those sections.
Madam Chair, actually,
we did.
With what Representative Paymar is trying to accomplish here, he would need that. Unfortunately, the amendment guts the bill because he's repealing my repealer, which is my repealer eliminates what on Representative Paymar's amendment is lines 5 through 10 or so and puts that back in. And now I understand the intent on the incest issue. I think we can work together between now and the floor to address that, but basically it guts the bill, and if House Research wants to comment on that too, that's fine, but I would oppose it.
Well, Representative Wilken or House Research, what about the sections that we just deleted, lines 7 through 14, that this refers to? Am I missing something? Ms. Benelli?
Madam Chair, I believe that Representative Paymar's amendment would delete
in line 16, reference to section 144.343, subdivision 1. That is not what was just deleted by Representative Walker's amendment. Representative Walker's amendment deleted lines 9 through 14. Representative Paymar's amendment would delete the references to provisions permitting minors to give consent for certain health care services involving treatment for pregnancy, venereal disease, and substance abuse.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Then it would not, as Representative Wilkins said, gut the bill. It would add an exception. Is that?
Ms. Bonelli.
Madam Chair, members, that is my understanding.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bonelli, what is the effect of on the Paymar Amendment of lines 15 and 16, that section 144.343 being stricken? What's the effect of that?
Ms. Bonelli.
Madam Chair, members, striking sections 144.343, subdivision 1, would repeal the provisions that allow a minor to give effective consent for medical, mental, and other health care services to determine the presence of and treat pregnancy and conditions associated therewith, venereal disease, alcohol, and other drug abuse, and the consent of no other person is required. I might add that Representative Paymar's, to be clear, Representative Paymar's amendment would leave in place 144.3441, which has to do with hepatitis B vaccinations.
That's the bill. Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If Ms. Bonelli would clarify one more time that he's putting back in the part that I repeal, is that applicable exclusively to incest victims, or would it be applicable still to other individuals?
Ms. Bonelli.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilkin, my understanding is that given Representative Paymar's amendment that the provisions of Subdivision 1 would only be applicable to a minor who has been the victim of incest.
Thank you, Ms. Bonelli. Representative Wilkin.
Talk amongst yourself for a second.
Yeah, the weather's really good today. If I ever went outside. No.
Thank you.
Representative Wilkin.
That's my, I had to use my lifeline. I hope I have one left. Question for Representative Paymar. Does this require reporting to law enforcement?
Representative Paymar.
In terms of what? In terms of the mandatory reporting, what?
Well, it,
Representative Wilkin.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, if we're going to say have an exception for a victim of incest, I would want to know that that incident is being reported to law enforcement so that... So that this minor gets out of the situation where they're being raped.
Representative Paymar.
If the minor told the doctor or whomever that they were the victim of incest, then, of course, the mandatory reporting would still come into play. That doesn't change state law. If the victim of incest did not report that they were a victim of incest but simply sought out treatment, then there would be no reporting.
Madam Chair,
maybe
House Research can clarify. Is it correct that when incest is reported that providers are indeed compelled by law to report to law enforcement authorities?
Ms. Bonelli.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilkin, I am not familiar with mandatory reporting requirements. The amendment before you, A5, does not, as I understand it, have any bearing on mandatory reporting requirements, but I'd be happy to get back to the members on that topic at a later time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Advice. I think the author of the amendment's intent is clear that this is meant to be for an incest
victim. And I think if the person didn't say it was incest, then the exception wouldn't apply. And so I think that in the discussion about the protections that come, I think that the intent's clear, and I think as this goes to Flora that there could be some work. I think if the amendment goes on, it would give both sides some reason to work together on it. And I think for now we should stick it on.
Absolutely, welcome.
Madam Chair, I agree. I can work with Representative Paymar between now and the floor, and if there's any minor changes we need to make to it, we'll do that. But I can neither. I guess our precedent is that we vote on it, but I will be voting in favor.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you. Just so I think I'm almost beginning to understand, but they use the opposite. This is that you can give consent, which means that in a sense means that the minor is empowered. If it's not a victim of incest, then they're not empowered to give the consent. And I think that's sort of where you were by getting rid of this section, except for the providing one exception before you were taking out the section entirely. I think I've interpreted that right. Is that?
No. Representative Paymar?
I'm sorry.
Is that? I know, I'm sorry, but.
Sorry, Representative Bradley. I
didn't know if you wanted to clarify the intent of your amendment more clearly. Just if you're able to do that. Representative Bradley had a question. Representative Bradley.
If you'd like me to repeat, if I read it correctly, what this is saying is that except for the case of incest, minors would not have the right to what's called make effective consent, which says that, in effect, that's the way you sort of block the parents being involved. So the only condition under which they can do that is if there's incest. Otherwise, in all other conditions, parent would have access.
Yeah, that's correct.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Spinelli, did you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, I have nothing to add. That is my understanding as well.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Okay. Representative Wilkin, you assure me this is set to go to the floor. I mean, there's no other committee it needs to go to, right?
I have not received a request from any other committee.
Okay. Chair. All right. Representative Wilkin renews his motion that House filed 352 be recommended to pass, be referred to the General Register. Any discussion? Seeing none, all
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
With my amendment, I just was hoping to fix a little piece of the bill. I still think the bill is incredibly flawed. I think that if this bill passes, it's going to exacerbate the problem. There's going to be more pregnancies. There's going to be more STDs, more HIV. I don't think this is the direction that we should be going. And I would hope that the body would use some common sense and vote this bill down.
Okay. All those in Representative Bradley?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I think we've had some really compelling testimony, and there's a wonderful series of ads these days on TV, which I think is good advice here, and that's the parent, the anti-Trump.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the committee is adjourned.